Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Osiris.
I'm so excited to tell you a bit about today's sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, Music Masters Collective hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available, but spots are extremely limited, so visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/inside to learn more.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to Inside the Musician's Brain. I'm your host, Chris Pandolfi from the infamous String Dusters, and this is episode 29. My guest a little later on today's episode is a phenomenal singer, songwriter, guitar player. She's got a new album on the way, and she's really making a name for herself lately. Madison Cunningham will be my guest today. This was a really interesting interview. She's got a great story. She's got all the potential in the world, and she just played Madison Square Garden with Harry Styles. So we got into talking about that and a million other interesting things. So stick around for that. I want to say a quick word about my sponsors this season before we get rolling. I have some really awesome sponsors, great brands that I'm very excited to have partnered up with. The first of those is Artistworks. Artistworks is your go-to for online music learning. They have an amazing roster of world-class musicians who are the teachers, and these musicians cover an extremely wide array of instruments and genres. And when you're a student at Artistworks, you communicate directly with these phenomenal teachers through their video exchange program, which is such a great idea and such a great way to learn music. You're sending in videos of yourself, playing tunes, working things out, whatever it is you're working on, and they check those videos out, critique them, and send you a tailor-made video in return. So this is not only an opportunity to learn from world-class musicians who are also world-class teachers, but it's also a way to target what you have going on specifically with your music. And it's really a phenomenal resource. I've heard nothing but great things, and I know a bunch of the teachers on there and can't recommend it highly enough. Check it out at artistworks.com. My other sponsor this season is Orvis. I love this brand. I've been a fan of Orvis from long before I got to know the great folks that work there, but I have had a chance to get to know them in recent years, and it's only deepened my appreciation for this brand. Really high quality products, of course, everything that you could ever need for fly fishing, but they also make all kinds of really great apparel for the outdoors, high quality, durable. So much of it is made in the USA. They have great products, but they also have a great mission, and they've done so much meaningful quality work in the field of conservation, and that is so incredibly timely right now, so incredibly important. If you're someone who gets outside in any capacity, you really need to think about how you can give back, how you can help preserve the natural world, and Orvis is really walking the walk in this area. And for me as a consumer, when I think about the brands that I want to support, these are really important aspects of what those brands are all about. So big thanks to Orvis for everything that they're doing in that area. Big thanks to them for supporting the podcast this season. And Thanks for the phenomenal gear. I was recently out with my Helios 8-weight trying to catch a carp here in downtown Denver, which I can tell you now from personal experience is not a very easy thing to do. But it definitely wasn't the rod's fault. Those Helios rods are excellent. Make sure you check out Orvis for all your outdoor needs. Inside the Musician's Brain is also brought to you by Osiris Media. Osiris is behind all kinds of great podcast content. Check them out. And we are also brought to you by Americana Vibes. That's the infamous String Dusters record label. And there are all kinds of really cool, really quality releases coming from Americana Vibes. So stay tuned. Some of you may have realized I took a few weeks off from my regular release schedule here at Inside the Musician's Brain because the String Dusters schedule has been very busy of late. But not only did we have a full slate of big shows, including our headline debut at Red Rocks here in Denver, but we were also down a man. So Andy Falco, our amazing guitar player, just had a baby. Congrats, Andy, Jasmine, and Violet. And their new son, Teddy, came into the world a few weeks ago. And Andy had to be home taking care of the family for a little bit longer than expected. And of course, we had his back, as we always do, because these things happen. That's life. And we needed to figure out how to adjust and roll on and keep the music going. We've missed enough shows in the last few years. But for a band like the String Dusters, you know, 15 years deep with the same five people and the synergy of the group along with all the shared musical experience and the repertoire, like those are things. And so finding someone to fill in for one of the band members is, wow, at first a very daunting task. I remember when I got the news and then thinking about these huge shows, Red Rocks, as I said, it was definitely daunting. And you're thinking to yourself, how can we replace someone in this band? Everyone is so essential in so many ways because of all that shared experience. And we brought in our brother and incredible guitar player, John Stickley. And I want to just take a moment to say huge props to Stickley for stepping up to the plate and doing such an amazing job for these shows while Falco was out. And Stickley was a guest here on Inside the Musician's Brain. Actually, he's very early on. He was in episode 4 in season 1 and always been a great friend, one of our favorite guitar players. Be sure to check out his amazing band, by the way, the John Stickley Trio. Such an incredible, unique sound. Phenomenal players, drums, fiddle, and guitar. Some great albums, lots of original music. Check them out. And yeah, Stick was definitely at the top of our list of players when we knew we were going to have to fill some very big shoes. We knew he would be a great fit, and we reached out, we got in touch, we made sure that he was available, we started to get travel stuff dialed in, and then it was on to the real work, the music. And I got questions from friends and family just about how this process works, so I figured I'd break it down really quick, because when I did explain even bits and pieces of it to people, it's definitely one of those things that if you're not a full-time musician, you know, knowing how a process like this unfolds can be a little bit of a mystery. So I sent Stickley a Spotify playlist. Get this. It was about 6 hours long, 60 songs, kind of prioritized with the new album stuff, which of course we're trying to feature at most of our shows these days. The new album stuff came first, and then it was on to, you know, the strong live String Duster songs that we regularly use in concert. But we had a lot of sets to cover. So we had 6 sets at B Chord in Virginia. Then we had Red Rocks. Then we had a weekend of festival sets. And of course, we don't really repeat a lot of songs. We get a lot of repeat customers, and we are always trying to mix things up in a major way when it comes to the set list. And so think about that. That's just a ton of music. You could work for hours, days, even on one song. Well, we're talking about learning close to 60 songs in a matter of a few days. And this is one of those skills that you definitely develop as a professional musician. And that's especially true in the bluegrass world, where this idea of filling in for people and sort of the interchangeability of the different instrument roles is a thing. So how do you learn all that music? Well, the reality is that listening actually comprises most of the work, getting the music in your head and often transcribing or learning the chords as a song is playing without your instrument in your hands. That's something that we have all learned how to do, an invaluable skill. Then it's a matter of kind of zoning in on difficult passages, learning melodies. This part will usually go down with the instrument in your hand and kind of putting it all together to understand the music. Now, keeping all this music straight, that can really be a challenge. But again, if you've listened enough and you have that strong reference in your head, then you'd be amazed. You know, you'd be looking at the set list and you'll see something that's completely foreign and then it gets going and you have a lot to fall back on. I remember that's how I felt when I filled in with Railroad Earth years ago when the late, great Andy Gessling was sick for the first time. I was playing with them and it was the same thing, just tons of music, tons of listening. And with Stickley, our first rehearsal was actually on the day of the first show. So I got the set lists done in advance. We brought Stick up to speed on the way we create and understand set lists as a group with our production meeting. I've talked about this before on the podcast. We have a production meeting 90 minutes before every set where we go over everything that we're going to play that night, talk through the transitions, anything that's unique to that night, the flow of the show, etc. Then after some last minute review, boom, hit the stage, let it rip, and John did amazing again. We were days in, so we got through Red Rocks and it went great. He did awesome. We were days into, you know, probably 5-6 show days into playing with Stickley. And I was pulling songs from way down this list and he pretty much had it all covered. I was impressed. We definitely benefited from our common bluegrass language, and I think we pulled out some traditional material that the Dusters had never even played. And the bluegrass connection helped definitely in that repertoire area, but also in allowing him to drop right into the groove and the feel of the music. I've always said there's no musical education like bluegrass. The rhythmic elements are so strong. The sense of melody is so strong. The concepts of ensemble playing, the roles that the instruments play are so perfect in the way that they fit together. And if you learn bluegrass, you know, you learn guitar from Tony Rice, or if you learn what Earl Scruggs did on the banjo, you are headed in the right direction. And bluegrass is also great at ear training. And ear training is really the best way to describe that skill that I'm talking about, that thing that professional musicians know how to do, to listen to a song and learn it just by listening to it. I always say that was my most valuable class at the Berklee College of Music, was ear training. We'd sit there and the professor would come in and he'd say, okay, here's middle C. He'd play one note and then he'd start to play through these progressions of chords. And little by little, your ear gets used to recognizing the relationships and knowing that, okay, we're on the one chord here, and oh, it just moved to the four chord, the five chord, and it becomes very second nature, and that act of listening turns into the act of learning. Now, all that said, we really did miss our man Falco, and it was incredible playing with Stickley, but it will never be exactly the same without the core five of us. And we are so excited to head out for the rest of the summer with Falco back on board. Everyone healthy, everyone ready to rip. All right, let's jump ahead now to my interview with Madison Cunningham. I cannot say enough great things about her music. It's tremendous. Give it a listen. Here we go.
Well, you'll never see me dying on screen or microscope. Sleep it all. Checking into heart.
All right, we're here on Inside the Musician's Brain, and my guest today is a phenomenal songwriter, singer, incredible guitar player, and really starting to make a name for herself, Madison Cunningham. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've really enjoyed listening to a bunch of your stuff that's on Spotify recently. The music is just so awesome. Congrats.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you have a full album out, Who Are You Now, that came out in 2019. But I love these new singles, Hospital and Anywhere. And I believe those are both this year, right?
Yes, yeah. Anywhere was released back in April, and then Hospital came out today.
Very cool. Yeah, these tracks are really unique and creative, great production, but your sound is just, it's so cool. It's like, to me, sort of like a study in contrast in a way. Like, there's really smooth, beautiful sounds in there, but there's also a lot of edge and like the guitar riffs. And of course, it's very hard to categorize genre-wise. Like, I don't even think we need to go there, because it's something really all its own. And I got to tip my hat to you for that, because that's hard to do these days. And, you know, the first thing I want to talk about is kind of how that all came to be. I read up on sort of your origin story with music, but would love to hear from you a little bit more about how and when you started playing, and, you know, when your relationship with music really got going.
Well, I guess we'll just have to go to the beginning. Where did it start? I was born in Escondido, California, and then moved to Orange County, where I spent the bulk of my childhood in the suburbs in a place called Costa Mesa. And my dad is and was a musician, a guitar player specifically, and he played acoustic guitar mainly. And I think I just really wanted to be exactly like him. He was, I think, the coolest reference that I had in my life of someone who just loved music and devoted his passion and effort to music. So I think that was the most contagious example I had of it at the time. So I started probably playing guitar when I was about 6 or 7.
Okay.
It's probably also worth noting that I was homeschooled, and so he would kind of give me these chords to mess with and kind of get under my fingers. Because, you know, when you're first starting to play guitar, it really hurts. And it takes a minute to get rid of the buzzing and to make sure that the chord feels articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he would just like give me a chord a day, and then he would leave for work. And then I would sit at home kind of working through my blisters and trying to just make the chord sound the way he made it sound. And I was just so frustrated, because I couldn't, you know, 7 years old and you're playing like a jumbo acoustic Taylor guitar, and like your hands are only so big and so strong. And so you're trying to work through that problem. And yeah, I think from there I think I just kept falling deeper in love with the guitar through different examples that kind of came through my life. A dear friend named Danny Donnelly was one of my favorite guitar players, and he really had an emphasis on playing rather complicated things on guitar while singing a top line over it.
That sounds like it certainly had an influence on you.
It totally did, because I just thought it was...
I hear that a lot, yeah, in your music.
I mean, I just thought it was the coolest piece of just like showmanship that I had ever seen. Like, because there was so much existing between his voice and what was happening with his fingers, and I felt like he created like a whole band just between himself, cool, and his guitar. So I think watching that from like 10 years old to then like my teen years, I think that subconsciously played a huge role on how I would come to uncover guitar and like my voice in that. But yeah, mainly was pretty much self-taught, and just I think I had a lot of great teachers by just watching these incredible guitar players that were around me and in my life, and kind of really took me under their wing. Danny was one of them. Bass player, producer extraordinaire Tyler Chester is also, like, on top of being an incredible pianist and producer and bass player, is just one of my favorite guitar players. And we spent so much time together since I was 15 to 16 years old to now. And the sheer nature of us working on music and just hanging out in a room and playing guitar, that taught me kind of all I needed to, that gave me all the tools that I needed to keep chipping away at it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I read in a few interviews that it's not like you had a bunch of Beatles records and you're like, I want to learn these songs. Or right. You know, you were exposed to that stuff, but not until a little bit later on. And I think you guys performed in church when you were young too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So my dad was a worship leader growing up. He's recently kind of stepped away from that for the time being. But he very much encouraged me to learn how to sing and play at the same time. And all of that was really kind of found and discovered within the walls of that church that I grew up in.
Do you think that was a big part, though, of shaping your journey with music, the fact that though you were around some really influential musicians, you weren't necessarily hearing like this classic canon of songs? Like I said, that kind of came a little bit later, but it sounds to me like that's something that really ended up contributing to the immense like level of originality with your music. Would you agree with that?
I would say so, because I think there was a necessary level of naivety that I had in music, because I felt like I was able to come to the creative table without feeling intimidated by like a bunch of towering figures, you know. Like I didn't feel like I had to sound like Joni Mitchell, or I didn't have to write like Dylan or any of those greats that you could possibly name. And again, they were so informative when they did come into my life, because I think I was maybe mature enough to hear them in a different way and to be informed by them in a more mature sense. But I think as a kid, I enjoyed music and I didn't feel the need to perform it or to perform. It was all for pure enjoyment and discovery. And I think as a kid, when you're exploring and you're in the midst of creating, you're not thinking about doing those things. You're not in your head analyzing that you are in that moment creating. You're just lost in whatever it is that's happening. And so for that reason, I'm thankful for kind of having a sheltered childhood in that way.
It's really interesting, because there are so many aspects of music that you need to master as a player, as a songwriter, producer, whatever it is. But originality is the thing that is really hard to teach. Maybe even you can't teach that. You know, you can learn these rudiments and you can pick up on different chords, even really unique elements of someone's music. But to find that thing, to have your journey ignite that thing that's unique about you, sounds to me like that's such a big part of what got you to where you're at. Do you remember when you wrote your first song?
I think I was probably 7.
Oh, wow. You got going early.
Yeah, no, the second that chords made sense to me and I could actually, you know, get through them and play them, I think I started on piano before guitar. So I was probably like 6 or 7 when I started piano, and then guitar came second. But songwriting made sense to me, or was at least a very immediate part of my journey as like a kid who loved music. And I don't necessarily know why. I think I must have, as the oldest of 5 kids, maybe just had a lot to get off my chest. I don't know. I had a very lovely childhood, so I don't know what I could have possibly had to write about, but I don't know. There was just like this natural diary-centric mode of writing for me, where I just, it all kind of just like worked together. I don't really know. My dad was also a songwriter, so I think also maybe it was just pure emulation.
But you gravitated right away toward, again, sort of on this originality front, just creating your own things. Were you writing music, lyrics, all of that as a 7-year-old?
It's really highly, deeply embarrassing, but I was. I was writing lyrics and music and...
Why is that deeply embarrassing? I think that's deeply awesome that you were doing that at such a young age.
I mean, I just... You say that until you hear it, and you're like, ooh, good thing that you made it to where you did today. But yeah, it certainly was very raw. We'll just say that. Very raw.
Well, there's still an element of raw in your music, which I really dig. Again, like, I just hear... I hear these different contrasting sounds, you know, I hear these like edgy kind of gritty riffs and then these amazing kind of soaring, beautiful vocal melodies. It sort of at the same time has this like dirty, raw sound, but also really, really catchy and obviously covers a wide range of, you know, different sounds and genres, bands. But what was it like when you did start to discover some of your really fundamental influences? You were obviously a little bit older, but how did that music come to you and what was that experience like?
I mean, it was almost dangerous because it was like giving a kid candy who had only ever had fruit their whole life.
Okay.
I almost lost a job that I had because... The day I graduated high school, I was like delivering cookies for this business that was starting up in my neighborhood. It was like the first like gluten-free kind of cookie business that emerged out of Orange County, and I found my way into that industry and by delivering cookies. And yeah, the day I graduated high school, Tyler Chester gave me Rubber Soul and Abbey Road. And as the story goes, when I put Abbey Road on, I think Come Together is the first song on that album, right? I'm almost positive.
I believe so, yeah.
It just, for lack of a better phrase, it just blew my mind. And I was driving to my destination and forgot to turn on the AC and melted all the cookies. But again, I just was like, I was on cruise control because I was still just trying to pick up the pieces of my brain and I wasn't thinking about anything else. Like everything else completely disappeared. So I walked into the grocer with these melted cookies and I just like never heard the end of it. I got put into an office and I tried to blame it on the Beatles and she did not take that as an excuse, understandably. And like, it was just, again, I think it really like opened up my brain and cracked me open in a way that I didn't know was possible. And that's what's so sweet about a musical community or just like education of the art that already exists and the history of it is that it teaches you what you didn't know you needed to know. Sure. And what you didn't think was possible. And I think few artists have been that way for me. I think Joni Mitchell's a huge one. Mm-hmm. 'Cause she was playing in open tunings and before I had heard her, I was dabbling in open tunings and writing a lot. And then she just completely, her writing and her approach to open tunings just schooled me. And I just, I still haven't recovered. And then Jeff Buckley, of course, like I think that was another, I don't know, soulmate, like artist. Like when I heard him, I just thought like, this is the music that, this is all that matters. And the way that he creates, like that's what I want to tap into. And, yeah, I don't know. Just there's certain artists that have come along in my life that have felt like they have said the thing that like my heart yearns to say, and those are some examples. Fiona Apple is also another one, and I think like you said, I really believe that the relationship of something that's like a little bit dark or grittier to something that is married to something more beautiful. I think that's a important relationship because that speaks to like the spectrum of kind of the human experience.
I love that. And I actually listened last weekend to Grace, from start to finish, because Rolling Stone, I don't know if you saw this, Rolling Stone published an article that I think was a reprinting of kind of Jeff Buckley's story. It really focuses on his drowning and how that all went down. But when I was in college, I'll never forget, my good friend Andrew gave me a copy of Grace, and I just had never really heard anything like it. And of course, Joni Mitchell is a great reference, because she's just tips the originality scales too, and you just hear things with the way her guitar and her voice interact. But Buckley is an awesome example of that thing that I've sort of been referencing. Like, there's this edge, and obviously his music has a darkness that's very tangible, you know, the lyrics. And of course, just looking at the story of his life, I mean, gone way too soon. But then there's like this amazing sweetness in his voice, you know, and it's really moving. And, you know, I saw somewhere else mentioned, I can't remember if it was an interview or what, but Juana Molina as a influence for you, which I love her music. And she's kind of got that too, you know. It's like there's like rawness there, but then there's just beauty that sort of like floats on top of it.
And again, originality. Like I there's no one that I could compare her to that I would even say shares similarities. It's like she's just her own universe, and she's created that. And she was another artist like that did that very thing for me, which completely like opened my mind to another way that music could be made.
Sure.
And I hadn't, and again, she's a guitar player. So like all of that intricate guitar work you hear, she's singing and playing at the same time. And when I made my first record in 2014, I was like still in high school. The drummer, Aaron Redfield, who played on it, just started playing her music, and he was like, I feel like you need to hear this. And I think somehow he knew that it was gonna, like, I don't know, shape me, or like it was the palette that I needed to hear. And I've been preaching the Juana Molina gospel for like years now.
Oh, she's so bad. That album, it's called like Wed 21.
It's the one.
Wed 21. Yeah, that's the one that could turn me on to her. And wow. Same. Talk about originality. So talk to me about the guitar, because you're a badass guitar player. Like, the guitar playing, and it's a really, really spot on combination of a few things. Like, first and foremost, it accompanies the song and the voice and brings it to life.
Yeah.
And yes, it's technical, and there's a lot of stuff that, you know, it's like you've done your homework, but it's also, again, just unique, and with the open tunings. Like, who are your, you know, when it comes more specifically to guitar, what are some things that you gravitate toward, or some players that you listen to and transcribe? Like, is that part of your music that you work on sort of independently, or is it more baked into all the songwriting? Like, how does all that look for you?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the songwriting goes, I do feel like the guitar has always made sense as the vehicle, or the main ingredient, or like the overarching like kind of sound for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think definitely took me a minute to find that, because I put out a record with like acoustic guitar, but I think when I put out my debut album, Who Are You Now, I felt like there was a specific trajectory that I wanted to embark on. And I think it had to do with making the guitar like the central theme. But I think I still wanted that to come second to the songs. So like, I wanted to make a signature writing style, which I don't know if that I found that or not. I think
you did.
There's no way to tell that.
you did, I think.
Thank you. But you know, I'm hoping that can even exist beyond a certain guitar sound, you know. But people who I heard first that I think geniusly kind of baked the guitar into the songs, and really I think figured out how to make the guitar an essential part of the songs, was like Blake Mills was a know, an obvious like influence for me. Ry Cooder.
Oh, cool.
He's a big one. Do you know who Adam Levy is at all?
I don't think I do. Who's Adam Levy?
I mean, incredible songwriter, but I think first and foremost, as a guitar player, he played all over Norah Jones' first record, Come
okay.
Away.
Okay.
And he just was playing around L.A. When I kind of was up and around there, and he was a major influence on me.
Cool.
Obviously, Buckley, I feel like he gets credited for his voice, but I don't know if people pay as much attention to, like, how incredible and innovative his guitar playing was. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Juana. Like, truly, those are, like, some of my heroes that I think have stretched my imagination when it came to guitar.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome list of influences, I have to say. Some spectacular artists who just have a really convincing sound, but also a sound that's completely all their own.
Yeah.
We'll get right back to my interview with Madison Cunningham after this very short break.
From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. Seriously, make it stop. Thankfully, there's one company out there that's giving you a much-needed break. It's Mint Mobile. As the first company to sell premium wireless service online only, Mint Mobile lets you order from home and save a ton. With phone plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed data delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month and get the plan shipped to your door for free, go to mintmobile.com/switch. That's mintmobile.com/switch.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil story made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is Henry Kay, host of the number one music history podcast, Rootsland. Come with me on a journey to Kingston, Jamaica, where we explore the world of reggae music and the untold stories of some of the genre's greatest legends. From the ghettos and tenement yards where the music was born to the island's iconic recording studios. We are so excited to team up with Osiris Media, the leading storyteller in music, because as you'll hear, sometimes the story is the best song.
All right, I want to shift gears a little bit. I'm curious to know, so I want to talk a little bit about how the last few years have impacted you, because, you know, we've had a lot of guests here on my podcast who are either mostly like established artists who have a long-standing career, and then the pandemic hits, and your story is a little bit different. And it feels like when 2020 hit, things were really teed up for you, and then just like the rest of us, everything got shut down. Mm-hmm. And now you're back with a vengeance, and you know you got a new record coming, and you've made good on some big plans that you had in the pipeline before the pandemic hit. And yeah, I looked at your tour schedule, lots of, you know, amazing shows coming up, Mount Joy, Lake Street Dive, lots of great stuff. But how, you know, I was struck by that and curious to hear a little bit more from you about what that felt like. 'Cause that must've been tough to feel like you really had momentum and ahead of steam, and then you got shut down, and then you have to figure out how to recover from that. So how did that feel? How did that play out?
Well, when the pandemic hit initially, I was kind of excited because I think I had come, and obviously I was excited in a naive way because I didn't realize what was to come. But I thought, oh, cool, 2 weeks of vacation. We've been really hitting the road hard and I'm exhausted. And obviously we know how it ends. But yeah, I think when I really look back on it, my record came out in August of 2019, and then we had those kind of 6 months to travel with that music, and then a couple months at the beginning of 2020, and then just nothing at all. And 2020 was supposed to be a writing cycle year for me. Like, that was the plan. But there was just a couple things that had happened, and I had gotten a random message from Harry Styles asking me to open up for him, and I had a couple other tours. So it just was like, it felt like there was momentum that was suddenly just completely, you know, severed.
Because the Harry Styles show, for example, that the MSG show, that went away.
Yeah, it did. Well, like, it got rescheduled for 2021, but there was this fear of, like, will it yeah. come back? And spoiler alert, it did come back, and right. we got to do that show, and it was very special. But I think there was just a lot of me reaching for, like, how am I going to get out of this period? Because now I'm not sure what it's going to look like on the other side, and what will be left for me. Like, what will I be coming back to? Do I have right. to start from scratch? And I wrote all the songs that are now on this record during that period, which was just incredibly difficult. Like, it was one of the hardest year and a half I've ever experienced creating. And I think music felt like, it didn't feel like a romantic outlet for me anymore. Like, it was this very, like, difficult, like, taking the sledgehammer to cement to try and, like, get to the soil.
Now, do you feel like that was because you felt like you had to be writing music, and so you just need to get it done? Or was it more of, like, a creative, personal thing? Like, it just wasn't happening.
It's probably a marriage of the two, because I simultaneously had this, like, job to do, right? And I have a contract with a label, so it's like, this has to happen right now. And I have all this time off, so there's that guilt also. And then there's just the reality of being completely severed from your friendships, from your musical community, and yeah. everything that kind of keeps that machine running and inspired, and all those, you know, sure. all of those factors were just gone. So I think I had to just kind of come from a different place. And also, it was really good for me. Like, I think I had to become an adult about it and be like, it's not always going to be easy, and it's okay if it's hard. Like, why are you so afraid of this feeling hard? I think the worst thing is not knowing what is up or down creatively, and not knowing if what you're doing is good. And I think I had a lot of months of that. And then there was just there was a switch where I think maybe just personal stuff amounted to me being able to be a little bit more honest. I don't know. I think I was cracked open. I lost my grandmother.
Yeah, I read about that.
Yeah, and I don't just the blow and the unexpected nature of that, just kind of, I don't know, all bets were off. Nothing felt precious anymore. And then everything felt incredibly precious at the same time. It was this sure. really weird kind of paradigm of, like, nothing matters, but everything matters.
Yeah.
Because time is all, literally all we have, and we don't have much of it. So, yeah, I think that kind of started this, like, very honest journey of me kind of making a promise to myself that I wouldn't withhold whatever it was that needed to be said, even if it felt ugly or felt too honest or whatever. Yeah. You know.
So you sounds like you came into some major perspective.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden things kind of open up. And yeah. and is that when you wrote the songs for this upcoming album?
Yeah, yes and no. I feel like the first song that really made the cut was the one about my grandma, called Life According to Rachel. And then everything else kind of came after that. Hospital okay. came shortly after, and the rest of the tunes, honestly. But it is funny how that works. It's like, you can't ever rush the songwriting process. You can't ever tell it what to do. You just kind of have to be a slave to it in a way.
So break that down for us one step more. That's really interesting. So when you say that, do you mean you just got to show up every day and put in the time versus, like, waiting for inspiration to strike?
I mean, I don't think there's any other way. I think the waiting for the inspiration to strike is kind of a pipe dream. I don't think that for me at least that doesn't happen as much as I wish that it did. And if it did, I would just be taking work off all the time and just waiting.
That's a very common theme I hear so much from songwriters, and you know, we all know this, but it just takes work. And
yeah,
you know, what you said a second ago too is really interesting. Getting over this hump of feeling like, okay, this is hard right now, you know, yeah, and it's not always going to be easy. So when you're in a period of, you know, call it writer's block or whatever, is that something that you feel like you're carrying around with you all day? Or is it more something that manifests when you pick up the guitar and you go to write a song? Is it something you're kind of like worried about? Like, how does that feel to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's writer's block is for me is a mixture of procrastination, number one, a mixture of fear, and also sometimes just not knowing where to start, because there's so many ways that you could go with writing a song, and mm-hmm, and so it can be a little bit of paralysis as well. But again, like my friend Mike Viola always says, he's like, I believe personally that writer's block is self-inflicted and that it's not real. And actually, just by him saying that completely, for whatever reason, changed my perspective and helped me to just, I don't know, write again. Because I was, if indeed it is, you know, of your own doing, then I don't know, it kind of allows you to be like, well, I'm just going to kind of throw words on the page and just see what happens. Like, what am I holding back? What's so precious that I can't jump into this?
Yeah, kind of remove some of those more self-imposed elements of it. Like you say, like procrastination, you know, you can just sit down and hammer something out, even if it's complete bullshit, you know,
totally,
like just to get moving towards something else.
It's like warming up. You have to stretch. You have to let yourself become malleable again. And I think there's a huge, we like to call it the moodling process, which is like you arrive and you might just kind of like sit around and nothing will happen. But even that was worth it. You just setting your intentions.
Wait, did you say moodling?
Moodling.
Like a combination of mood and noodling.
Exactly.
I like that. I like that.
And it's a little bit nomadic. Like there's no purpose but to set intention and to say, here I am, come what may, rain or sunshine, whatever it is, I'm here and I'm going to like set my focus to where it needs to be. And again, it might just be a stupid ass song that you just have to get out of the way. I have plenty of those. Plenty.
But it's such a, to me, that's always something, like, for example, when I hear back from people who listen, you know, to these conversations, they're always surprised to hear the amount of sometimes, yeah, like the moodling part, you know, where you just have to show up. They think that every piece of music is some divine inspiration and they don't realize that. And of course, you know, this is like, can be the most annoying thing ever, that usually the people who are most talented also work the hardest by far, you know?
Totally.
And it's like, you know, guys like Bela Fleck and Chris Thiele, it's like, okay, well, you obviously have all the tools, but they also just show up and make that happen. And it's not, it's not just magic every time, you know, there's a great, great lesson in that.
Yeah. I mean, it's also very easy to fantasize about artists who make great music and thinking to yourself like, oh, they're just, it's just easy for them. And really that line of thinking is just one fat excuse to not put in the work yourself.
Yeah.
Cause no one is, I think we're all, for me, a lot of my songs have been born out of divine frustration. and just trying to like take what was an initial easy idea to completion, like all the steps that have to happen in between the easiest part, which is an idea.
Yeah.
And finishing that idea, there can be just a lot of, you know, like hitting your head against the wall because you're just like, I just don't know how to finish this or where to go. And again, I think that's why a musical community is so important, because sometimes the answers are just like simpler than you think. And maybe a fellow artist could point it out, you know, in a day. Whereas sometimes I do like to write alone, though I that's kind of my happy place. And because I don't have to justify my initial instincts, I can just kind of let it happen and then correct later if it needs to be corrected. But
so you have all these cool kind of tools in your arsenal, the guitar stuff, and obviously you're singing, the songwriting, and you know, odd time signatures and just like really cool voicings. Like there's all these different things that end up in the final product. But when it comes to the songwriting process, do you feel like you're pretty formulaic in terms of which one of those pieces you chip away at first? Or could it be anything that leads you down a certain road, a lyric, a chord, or whatever?
It definitely could be anything. Okay. Like I can't necessarily predict what it'll be that will kind of kick off a song. But I do think that there's an accidental formula that happens, which is guitar usually has to happen first.
Okay.
Like something there needs to be sparked in order for me to find ultimate interest. But that's not, again, like I say that, but that's not fully true, because there has been songs that have come lyrically first, and then I figure out the guitar pieces later. And I do think it's important to serve the song first. So I try to not just turn to guitar, because sometimes that can be like a, you know, a cyclical thing, a rut that I can find myself in.
Okay. This is a random question, but I'm so curious. On Anywhere, what is the instrument playing that cool, like, creepy melody, you know, once, not the guitar riff at the top, but it almost sounds like a steel drum or like an electric guitar with a bunch of effects or something. What is that?
The da, 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 any day now. Seek and you'll find her.
That is
a piano.
Oh, okay.
A piano with a, was it a felt piano? Yeah, I think it was a felt piano with like a delay, like effect that was put on afterwards.
And so then cool.
Some distortion, I think.
So, like that melody, did you write that, or is that something like where you're teaming up with your producer in the studio? Do you have all that stuff mapped out before the sessions go down?
Not necessarily before. I will do some mapping out beforehand, but that line was, yeah, I wrote that.
And it's a sick little melody.
Thank you.
It's so
appreciate
cool.
It. And it was also one of those things, sometimes I stumble on melodies by accident, by just kind of like, if I have an idea of the kind of instrument I want to hear and that it needs kind of a place or a purpose, then I'll figure the melody from that point.
Okay. So talk to me about this new album, Revealer, coming September of this year.
Yeah.
So what's new? What's different? I read that thematically that you definitely were inspired by your grandmother and the loss of your grandmother, but what is this album all about to you?
I think it's, to me, it feels like a rediscovering of my self and my interests, because I was so blocked creatively. I feel like this record was me kind of coming back to the foundation of why I love music and why I love songwriting. And I think that happens to be because songwriting is such a beautiful mode of processing very, very hard things. And for a second, it can like take you out of those realities and into a space that you want to be in for a while. And again, it wasn't an easy process for me to make it, but these songs are so enjoyable to play and to hear back that I feel so lucky that it turned out that way, because it very well could have not been that way. But I think because I don't know, a good amount of wise people around me who encouraged me to just keep digging at it and going back to the drawing board and trying again. And I wanted this record to not hide any of the things that I was thinking or dealing with. And I think it also kind of just deals with a lot of my battles with anxiety and a little bit of depression and it's a little bit more autobiographical than I have been in the past.
And do you feel like giving a voice to some of those things that are hard for you is a way of, I don't know what the right word is, but just dealing with them, getting past them?
I don't know if it's helped me get past them. I think it's helped me face them.
Okay.
And I think I've realized that they're things like grief and like anxiety and like depression that just are bound to stay.
Okay.
And I'm bound to experience more of, but at least for me, in being honest that they exist, it helps me to work through them, but I don't think I'll ever get past them. It gets me comfortable with their residence in my life.
Well, that's probably a great way to look at it, because that is life. And there is no, you know, I think the more we feel like we're in control, that can be a dangerous road, you know, and a little bit of the letting go is oftentimes what helps us find a little bit more peace. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. And I do think that if you believe that you are completely in control, that the reality of those things forementioned, grief, anxiety, et cetera, hit harder. It's harder to grapple with those things if you're not at least surrendered to the fact that they exist and they are a part of life. And again, I think it's worth mentioning, do not consider myself to be an expert on any one of these things. I do feel like talking about them is me not wanting to preach about those subjects. I think they go deep and they can exist on a spectrum and everyone has their own, you know, version of them and experience. But I think the admittance that they exist in my life was important for me to convey, and in order to create an honest reflection in the music.
Yeah. Well, and that honesty is what resonates with people and gives a voice to whatever they're feeling. And that's like one of the most powerful things in music, you know, and I'm sure that's something that, you know, you're able to create for the people who are listening, which is awesome. I commend you on that.
Thank you.
So what about the recording process for Revealer? Do you rehearse this stuff heavily before you go into the studio, or do you like to keep it really fresh? And how does the tracking process go down for you?
It was so sporadic this time, again, because it was in the middle of trying to navigate how to do things in the middle of COVID. So each song had a different shelf life before bringing them into the studio, and I recorded them all kind of separately. Maybe in December of 2021 was when I recorded the most songs at once, but ultimately I would kind of record one song at a time.
Okay.
And that's kind of the way I wanted to do it. I kind of wanted to write a song and then be able to go in and record it and kind of really focus on it, because the last record was the complete opposite, which was working all the songs up, parts and bass parts and all the things beforehand, so that when we went into the studio we could like get one live take of it.
Sure.
So yeah, we did that. We finished that record in 2 weeks, and this one was like literally made over the course of a year and a half, which I don't know that I'll ever do again, because I like things to just be like intentionally done in a certain amount of time and then being able to be free from it and mm-hmm. move on. But it was a great learning lesson for me, because I really wanted to try that style of recording. And I worked with three different producers this time, which was crazy. It was so fun and challenging for me, because I really was out of my comfort zone. I didn't really, and that was very important to be there, I think.
So what do you mean by that? Out of your, was that because you feel like these producers were pushing you into new zones or things that were just going on and you're like, what does that feeling come from?
I mean, I think each producer naturally brings their own thing to the table. And I had always just worked with Tyler Chester and we did do most of the songs on the record together, but I do feel like it was cool to experience, you know, just different approaches. And Tucker Martin was one of them. And then, and then Mike Elizondo.
Okay.
And so they each just brought something that challenged me to the table. And, I guess that's what I mean by
out of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and just to be clear, the singles Hospital Anywhere, these are going to be on this upcoming record, right?
Yes, okay. Exactly.
Cannot wait to check it out. I'm so excited. I'm a big new fan. And I got to ask before we wrap up, what's it like to be on stage at Madison Square Garden opening for Harry Styles? Like, seriously, what is that like?
I feel
How
like
that it, feel.
This is going to be a really weird example, but just bear with me. What it felt like to me, and this is also me not knowing what this feels like, but from how it's been described, is like being like on an operation table and being completely awake while they're operating on you.
Okay.
That's how it felt. It was like that level of scariness, but real consciousness and clarity. And again, I think the operation table metaphor runs short because it wasn't at all painful. It was like the most enlightening and wonderful experience. And the audience was like, so kind to us and like actually very much paid attention to every moment and every note. And that just really impacted me. I think that really had to say something about the way that Harry kind of invites guests into his orbit. And I think he really, really prepared the stage for us in a way that was like, these are my guests, pay attention. And that just was so life-changing. And so, yeah, I'll never forget it.
Do you know how he discovered your stuff?
I think it was through one of his band mates. I think they showed him a video during rehearsal, one of his rehearsals, and then I guess he was walking on the street listening to my record, and then he got robbed by like six dudes or something. And then shortly after that, he reached out, and the rest is history. Yeah, super wild. I really, really can't stress enough how much I didn't expect that record to make it to that world. So
very cool. Really cool. Well, you deserve it. So you have a lot of shows coming up.
Yeah,
you're about to hit the road pretty hard, and I saw, like I said earlier, a bunch of shows with Mount Joy, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And our friends Lake Street Dive, love those guys. We've played with them many times. And then you also have a bunch of shows that are your own headlining shows coming up, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's a wonderful mixture of the two. I think the bulk of the touring kind of happens from September to October,
okay,
which are headlining shows. And then I think we're going to be touring a little more in November, but okay, that's yet to be announced.
Well, I got to say, I'm a huge fan. Congrats on all your well-deserved success. And I hope we get to meet up and hang out one of these days. Not sure where, but I'm sure it'll happen one of these days. Look for the string dusters when you see, you know, the festival lineups you're on or whatever. And
let's find
the time to cross paths. But thank you so much, Madison, for joining me on the podcast today. And best of luck with everything you got coming up.
Thank you so much for this beautiful conversation. Really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. That's a wrap on episode 29. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Huge thanks to our amazing guest today, Madison Cunningham. Check her out. Her new album, Revealer, is on the way this September. A huge shout out to our sponsors this season. Orvis is your go-to for all your outdoor needs. Artistworks, your go-to for online music learning. We are also brought to you by Osiris Media and Americana Vibes. If you dig what you're hearing, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. You can't imagine how much that helps. We've got one more episode to go in season 3. And if everything goes according to plan, that will air right here in 3 weeks when we go back inside the musician's brain.
Osiris.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like Chicago's.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles, The Wrath of the Buzzard, PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.